You're listening to Around Comics, episode 89.
Chicago, this is Around Comics, a roundtable discussing topics in and around the world of comics. I'm your host, Christopher Niesman. I'm joined, as always, by the co-host of the show, Mr. Brian Salazar.
Hello.
And Mr. Tom Caters.
I'm very happy to be here. Really, it's really fun.
Jeez, Tom, you've put on some weight.
I ate Tom Caters. Tom was sitting here.
John Suntress, the man who ate Tom Caters.
Hello, I'm Morgan Freeman.
That's a Silver Age book.
I was there the day that Suntress ate Tom Caters. It was the day the Penguins still talk about amongst themselves.
themselves.
Towards the pole.
How you doing, Johnny?
I'm doing fine.
Okay, he doesn't break boys. What a professional. Tom is taking the night off. He's filing taxes, I believe. Poor guy.
Ouch, poor bastard.
So John's going to help us out a little bit. We're going to be talking with writer, editor, letterer, creator extraordinaire, Mr. Richard Starkings.
Animal lover,
Mr. Richard Starkings, in just a couple moments.
At least I assume.
You would think.
I believe he's a vegetarian.
Is he truly?
I believe that's Richard Starkings is a vegetarian. I believe I read that in an interview with him somewhere.
Well, there you go. And I'm sure we'll learn all about that and more in a couple moments.
Why aren't there any penguins?
But first, I'd like to let you know that this episode of Around Comics is sponsored by InStockTrades.com.
InStockTrades.com would like to welcome Richard Starkings to the show and let all our listeners know that they have both of the critically acclaimed Hit Flask hardcover editions discounted by 35%. You can now follow the Eisner Award-winning adventures of futuristic detective Hit Flask and the Elephant Men for just $19.47 per volume. Remember that InStockTrades.com is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more. All at great discounted prices. And all orders over $50 ship free.
And thank you to the fine folks at InStockTrades.com. Actually, just put in the order for my Volume 1 of Hip Flask. And
I was going to do the same thing today. I didn't, but I plan on it.
It's a fine deal. I'm going on my belated honeymoon, so I'm getting all my reading stuff together. So I got the absolute long Halloween.
Chris, I'm ready. Wait, honey, Captain Adam's really involved in something very serious here in the Wildstorm universe. I have to get this settled before
I'm finally
going to
read Adam Strange. Planet Heist.
That's Andy Diggle at his best.
Yeah, so, and the Hip Flask. And I've got...
honey, this is just for the plane, I swear to God.
What's in that other suitcase?
What a nerd. I knew there was a reason that Marta invited me on the honeymoon. I was wondering what it was for.
You talk to him, I can't even deal with
it. She has forbade me from bringing the laptop. So no,
I can't
say
I blame her.
Dude,
you're a geek, dude.
Your honeymoon.
You're going to a resort, a Caribbean beach resort, and you're worried about a laptop and comic books.
Well, how am I going to post on the forum?
Marriage is consummated.
Give me
thought you'd like to know. There's a nice thread.
Give me your man card if you even have.
Way to go! You the man.
You are.
No, I did.
Pat Leica has a comment.
I did buy a big boy. Book. I'm going to read Men of Tomorrow while I'm on a vacation.
Jesus,
so.
Man.
What?
Men of Tomorrow is great.
Yeah, I'm going to read it on the
Gerard
beach.
Gerard Jones, excellent.
I'm going to be there for like 8 days. I can't have sex for the entire 8 days.
Why not?
It's your honeymoon, man.
I'm a dork. That's why. I can't be separated from the comics.
Right. It's Men of Tomorrow.
Sorry, Marta.
You should have, honestly, after
this is what you married.
Get Gerard Jones. He's great. He's excellent.
I love what I... I
bet it tomorrow, Gerard Jones. Oh. Excellent book.
I haven't read it.
Well, folks, Around Comics was recorded every Friday at 7 o'clock at Dark Tower Comics. I'm just thinking what Tom would have said for that entire thing. But we are recording
what he would have said.
Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles.
What a loser.
Located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by. We would love to meet you.
Don't forget, your Around Comics experience isn't complete until you've read this week's Long Box of Love. Each Thursday episode of Around Comics is a wonderfully handcraft webcomic from Brian Bowles. Check it out every Thursday at www.aroundcomics.com.
Damn it, I knew I forgot something. I forgot to put up last week's, or this week's.
I need to apologize to Brian and anybody else that tried to email us in the last couple weeks. Apparently, with the server switch over, our email was a little messed up. So
yeah, we're still having problems, I think, of like people that are sending us emails and we're not getting them or something. I don't know. Something is going. Something weird
Brian
is going on.
Brian thought that we didn't like the strip
anymore. He thought we were just like ignoring him. And just we didn't want to talk.
And we thought it was like, man, he must need a break because he's not sending. You know, so maybe he just is taking some time off. And okay, that's fine. So Brian, we love the strip. Everybody loves the strip, and we're going to get those caught up. And anybody that has emailed us and we haven't gotten back with you, we may not have gotten the email. So
try again. You can come
except for the spooky guy in Canada, we got the email.
Yeah. We could. You can come on our forum and post. If you're a member of the forum, you can always send us a private message, or we have other email addresses if you really need to get a hold of us. But there you go.
There you go. All right. Well, this week's guest has been a writer, editor, and acclaimed font designer, starting in the UK with 2000 AD and moving on to Marvel UK as an editor. Richard Starking soon turned his attention to the development of computer-based comic book lettering. Since 1992, Comicraft has been a leader in lettering and custom font design. It's nearly impossible to walk into a comic shop and find books that haven't been touched by Comicraft's influence. Starting out as a mascot for Comicraft, the character Hip Flask is now the title character in his own series, as well as appearing in The Elephant Man, a dark and gritty tale set in the future where the lines between man and animal are blurred. The world of The Elephant Man has become one of Around Comics' favorite titles, and Around Comics is happy to welcome Richard Starkings. Oh, Richard, welcome to the show, and thank you for being on Around Comics.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. You have a very long and storied history, and I guess we should probably start at the beginning with, 2000 AD is where you got your start with comics?
Not really. The first job I got was on a comic book called The Wizard and Chips Holiday Special.
Of course.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
You've all read it. Captain Kidd was the strip that I lettered in there. Cut a long story short, I'd written to a lettering artist who did work on 2000 AD. He lettered Rogue Trooper back in the day, and his name was Bill Nuttall.
Cool.
Actually, the book that we created, Comic Book Lettering, The Comicraft Way, is dedicated to him. He died a couple of 3 years ago. So I wrote to Bill because I really felt that if I wanted to get into comic book lettering and I wrote to someone in America, their experience wouldn't be appropriate to the British market, where I was more likely to get work. Bill's style had some similarity, I felt, to Tom Wazakowski. He had a very crisp lettering style that I wanted to emulate, so I wrote to him, and it turned out to be a very good choice because he wrote me back. Not only did he write a letter, he sent me some samples to in order to sort of point me in the right direction in terms of how to improve my lettering work. And he sent the samples that I sent in response to that to a gentleman by the name of Bob Painter, P-A-Y-N-T-E-R, who was in charge of assigning lettering at IPC magazines, which is at the time was the parent company of 2000 AD. So I got a job through them and then heard nothing again. I did a 3-page strip. It wasn't a great job. It did get published, though. and I heard no more. In the interim, there was an ad for a job as art assistant, meaning basically a paste-up artist, mm-hmm. at Marvel UK in one of the quality newspapers, The Guardian. And I applied for that job, initially didn't get it, but was offered some lettering work on Transformers when Simon Furman had just started writing Transformers.
Wow.
Aeons ago. Simon's been writing Transformers longer than most of you have lived. So I started picking up freelance work at Marvel UK, and I think got my first Future Shock from 2000 AD at around the same time. And there was one other job at that time for a magazine called Lookin, mm-hmm. which was a weekly comic that ran two-page strips based on TV shows like $6 Million Man and Charlie's Angels and Buck Rogers. And they had a lot of top artists working for them because they paid top rates, because they were funded by TV Times, which is like a TV guide magazine in England. I did a two-page strip, which was the story of a pop group called Buck Fizz. I lettered that, and even though I got paid, much to my shame, a much better letterer was asked to re-letter it. So those were my beginnings.
Well, you know, a lot of folks, whenever they start reading comics, will and whenever they start to aspire to get into the business, either want to be artists or writers. What was it about
pencilers?
Well, or inkers, or you know, even but
which are all artists.
You rarely hear about people that's like, I really want to be a colorist or I really want to be a letterer. What was it about lettering that you know appealed to you and you saw as you know something that you wanted to do?
That's kind of hard to say, but I will tell you that I never have and never will think of myself as a letterer. I think of myself as someone who makes comics. I don't even think of myself as a writer or a designer, and I have drawn my own cartoon strip. But the truth was, there was an article in Warrior magazine, Des Skin's Black and White Monthly, that launched Thief of Vendetta, uh-huh. Axel Press Button, and Marvel Man.
Yeah.
And there was a how to get into comics. And one of the things that they said was, you're much likely to get in as a lettering artist than as an artist, writer, or any other sort of discipline. So I thought, easy way in. Sounds good to me. So I would say that it was a question of how do I get my foot in the door. I really did want to work in comics, and from the age of about 16 or 17, I felt it was all or nothing to work in comics. I really couldn't imagine myself being a doctor or a bricklayer or any job in between there. I really wanted to work in comics. And so I moved down to London, started lettering without being paid for a company called Harrier Comics, which was part of the Black and White explosion in 83-84. They did a book called HMS Conqueror, one called Red Fox. They did a whole bunch of books that ultimately died a horrible death. They were all launched on the back of the sort of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Cerebus Black and White boom.
Yep.
So I was basically finding any opportunity to improve my lettering skills, and finally managed to get a job, a paying job. So,
Hey everybody, it's Sal. Just wanted to step in here for a second. At this part of the interview, Richard actually had to step away from the phone for a moment to answer the door. He thought it was the postman, but as we'll find out next, it was actually something a little bit different.
That was actually something much more exciting than a delivery. That was the police department.
Get out of here. What'd you do?
I had a report that the transient was in the bushes, possibly around my house. So,
oh, God.
I had the door wide open because I like to hear when the mail or, you know, we have my studio's on the back of my house. Sometimes deliveries are made at the front, so I leave the front door open. So they were worried that the guy might have come in and started helping himself to my valuables.
He was stealing your fonts?
Obviously, he's in cahoots with you guys.
Yeah, exactly.
He knew that I'd be on the phone.
That's Caters.
It was Tom.
5:30 and 6:30.
That's where our other host is.
The transient pram outside doesn't fool me.
Damn, boiled well, again.
If the line goes dead, we'll know why. We'll call the
911,
the LA police.
All right. Anyway, where were we?
Well, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you about, and I had read that you kind of started whenever you were like 17 or so, working on like a Doctor Who fanzine.
I self-published five Doctor Who fanzines between I think I was 16 or 17, right up until my early 20s. I did a Doctor Who fanzine, and really for me it was an opportunity to draw the covers of the fanzine, and also I did a cartoon strip that was published in there. After three issues, other fanzines picked up my comic strip, and I submitted it to them. So, those were in the days I used. The first fanzine we did was done on one of those duplicating presses, mm-hmm. using a fluid. I've forgotten the name of it, but
A duplex machine, yeah, or the duplicator.
It sounds like it's one of those old things at school for duplicating papers. It was called a duplicator. It was mm-hmm. it was in the days before photocopiers.
With the purple ink,
yeah,
purple ink,
yeah. Oh, sure,
which actually turned black,
like mimeograph.
Yeah, mimeograph.
Yeah, that's what a mimeograph.
I remember that.
That's what it was.
And the back when we did mimeograph back in 1948, it was the only way to go.
To type the pages, which actually taught me a lot about setting type.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You had to type everything on this paper that basically the typewriter's keys cut a hole in the paper. That's why a lot of the E's would fill in, because they couldn't hold the counter of the E. So that was when I was 17, which is nearly 30 years ago. And I did three issues while I was at school, and then I did another, it was sort of fan fiction compilation when I was at college, and then I did a collection of my Doctor Who cartoons when I lived in London in 84, I think. So and those were sold at the Westminster Mart at the fan fiction table run by Paul Gravett, who's now something of a comics historian in England. He's written two books, one called Graphic Novels and one called British Comics, I think, recently. Yeah. And Paul Gravett was a patron of up-and-coming young comic creators at the Westminster Mart, which is a small convention, basically. It's a gathering of creators that happened once a month in London.
Wow.
And you would often see everybody working comics in the pub next door. So you'd be there with Alan Moore, Dave Gibbons, Kevin O'Neill, Mick McMahon, Brian Bolland, Warren Ellis, I think, used to be there. Glenn Fabry.
Good God.
Kev Hopgood. It was one of those rare occasions where you didn't realize at the time that it was sort of a seminal moment in comics. Eddie Campbell would be there.
Cool.
And in fact, Eddie Campbell drew a little panel of the creators in the pub at Westminster. In one of his books, I don't know if it was the Life of the Artist.
Oh, Portrait of the Artist.
Portrait of the Artist. Is it Portrait of the Artist?
Yeah,
How to Be an Artist?
Well, his latest...
One of his books, he referred to that, and I actually referred to it in an interview, and we started a whole thread on the Pulse, I think it was. And it was strange to me. Everybody that remembered those days remembered them very fondly. Phil Elliott, Mike Collins... there was a lot. Dave McKean was there telling everybody how he didn't want to draw Judge Dredd. it was very strange, looking back, how many sort of giants in the industry were there and how important it was to sort of get together every month and talk comics.
And plan the invasion? Is that's what you guys were really doing?
Before you guys came over and took over American comics?
That's what we were plotting.
Indeed.
Yeah. How to put all you guys out of work.
Like Ocean's 11, you guys unfurl the map. It's like, all right, here's how we're moving in.
This is New York. Stan Lee is
dead. I'm the unsung hero of the British invasion because a lot of people don't know I'm British. And
true.
In fact, some British creators who've worked on 2000 AD that I've got to know since I lived here have called me and not realized I was English. You know, some people think that I was an American creator living in England, and now people think that I'm an American.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's kind of one of those ironies that even though I sort of moved into the American industry and made waves, because I did so at a sort of auxiliary creator level, it's not sort of remarked upon, but I definitely think that sort of British wave of talent benefited me because I got to know Brian Bolland, and because I was cheeky enough to ask him at a convention if anyone he knew was lettering The Killing Joke, he asked me, which was my intention all along, of course. And when I moved to America, when I came here on a visitor's visa in 89, all I had to do was tell people I lettered The Killing Joke, and they gave me work. So that was immensely important to me. If Alan Bryan had made that Atlantic crossing, I wouldn't have been able to make it so easily.
Wow, that's really cool. Well, before we get into your time in America, I was curious about your Marvel UK editing and how that came about, what titles you were presiding over.
Well, I got the job as an art assistant.
Mm-hmm.
I was pasting up the editorial pages and making the legend corrections on Spider-Man Comics Weekly before that ultimately folded and we started running Secret Wars reprints.
Was Spider-Man Comics Weekly just reprinting the Marvel American story?
Yeah, it's okay. Continuously, you know, the Marvel UK, which is now Panini UK, has always reprinted Spider-Man because Spider-Man's always sold pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
As a reprint. The continuity is often all over the place because if you're printing a story weekly and you run 11 pages of Spider-Man in each issue, then you need two Spider-Man books. It doesn't necessarily mean that you picked up Spectacular Spider-Man at a convenient point in the continuity that marries together with Amazing Spider-Man.
Okay.
So it was a real juggling act to pick stories and make them fit, chop them in half, run a tagline, have a splash page for the next issue. We learned a lot simply because we were chopping and changing things, creating new covers. Sometimes we'd have to create a cover from a splash page. Sometimes we'd have to pick and choose images from the strip to make a cover. And sometimes we would commission a cover. But we didn't have much of a budget for that, and management was dead set against it. So as editorial assistants and art assistants, we had to be really creative. Plus, these were pre-computer days, so we were working with a stat machine. We were casting off type, sending it out to a typesetter. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot about the cost of letter set, which was extremely significant to me later. And I really had to do everything. And ultimately, I became an editor on Action Force, which was a relaunch of G.I. Joe.
Okay.
And at that point, because Transformers had been so successful, at its height, Transformers was a fortnightly, which means every other week.
Mm-hmm.
Which sold 127,000 copies a week, which was right up there with 2000 AD at the time. So it was making so much money, they started generating material, which is what brought me in as a letterer and what started Simon's career at Marvel UK as a writer. And from there, when we started doing G.I. Joe, it was taken for granted that we would originate, I think, 22 pages of new material a month. Which we were printing in each weekly, 5 or 6 pages a week. And in the back, we would reprint things like the Michael Golden G.I. Joe annual, a lot of the Herb Trimpe stuff, anything that we could chew shoehorn into our continuity, we would use. But as with Transformers, on the Action Force G.I. Joe book, everything was tied into product launches. And product launches by Hasbro for G.I. Joe and Transformers in England were not the same as they were in America. They would launch different items from the range at different times, which was good because it meant we had to originate material. So it's kind of strange that a lot of creators in Britain got their first breaks simply because of Hasbro's launch schedule. But I edited Action Force for a year before it folded. We did 52 issues, I think, and then it folded. And then I worked on Real Ghostbusters, which was another fortnightly, every 2 weeks. On that magazine, on Action Force, it was always hard to bring in new talent. We had a guy called Jeff Senior working for us who was amazing, very fast, very capable, very strong artwork. He did most of his work on Transformers. He did a little bit of work for me on Action Force. But I was constantly looking around for new talent. One of the first guys I had was Brian Hitch.
Wow.
16 years old.
Whatever happened to that guy?
I have no idea. I've heard that he's just as hard to work with now as he is then. At 16, he was very, very strong-willed and very capable, but also a lot of self-doubt at that time, of course, at 16. When you start to earn a living straight out of school, I think there's a lot of pressure on him. He was still living with his parents at the time. Dougie Braithwaite, I hired when he was 15.
He's awesome.
He did a Thundercat story for me when he was 15. Not only is he a great artist, he's one of the sweetest people in comics, you ask anybody.
A real gentleman, yeah.
Yeah, really sweet, sweet guy. Andy Lanning.
Sure.
Started working for me on Ghostbusters. He's a very talented penciler. He's made his name as a writer, as an inker. His style is very cartoony, which worked perfectly for Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. He's never really had a break as a penciler in America. Anthony Williams, who did some work on Gambit and some other X-Men books, started working for me on Action Force also. Dan Abnett was my assistant editor on Ghostbusters, and his first script was actually illustrated by Brian Hitch. That was, I think, Brian's first story also. So there was a lot. It was great to be able to originate material because you were able to break new talent. Unfortunately, most new talent headed straight for 2008.
Sure.
Because the licensed properties were not exciting or interesting to artists, and 2000 AD paid better. And of course, the karmic retribution there was anybody that went to 2000 AD eventually went to Vertigo. So the British invasion was basically a brain drain from our point of view as British publishers.
Hi, my name is Tony Danza, and you're listening to Around Comics. Hi, my name is John Romita Jr., and you are listening to Around Comics.
Well, talk about a little bit of how you went from the Marvel UK to coming over to the States and you know, getting involved there and then starting up Comic Craft.
Even when we were working on Transformers and G.I. Joe, Simon and I particularly would always talk about doing an American format comic. Tom DeFalco was actually sent to Marvel UK in about 87, I think, and ostensibly because he was helping us, he was a guiding light for us. I later heard that he and Jim Shooter were having a lot of arguments, and they were sort of sent to the corners of their room to cool off. So Tom was a really big influence on us, and in fact, Tom was very impressed with the weekly format and particularly enjoyed 2000 AD. Went back to Marvel and started Marvel Presents, the fortnightly American Marvel book, which nobody remembers except for Weapon X. Weapon X was serialized in Marvel Presents. I think, wow. Was it called Marvel Presents?
Yes.
Sure.
Marvel Comics Presents, yes.
It was three 8-page stories every 2 weeks. So, but while Tom was with us at Marvel UK, he really encouraged us to do an American style monthly. So I was working for editor Ian Rimmer at the time, and Ian tried to set the ball rolling. Ultimately, Ian left the company, and it was sort of dropped in my lap. And I went to meet with John Wagner and Alan Grant, who were working together as a writing team at the time, writing Judge Dredd and Strontium Dog for 2000 AD. And the management at Marvel UK wanted to do a American-style monthly, but they really wanted to go with top British talent. So we spoke with John and Alan, who at that time were sort of stung by the fact that they didn't own Judge Dredd. This was before Wagner made a deal with Fleetway and got a piece of Judge Dredd. So they didn't want to do a book for us unless they had a very, very... Either they were very well paid or they had a share in the character. And Marvel UK was not willing to do that. Mm-hmm. So I turned around and started working with Simon Furman about some ideas that he had. And that produced a comic called Dragon's Claws. Originally it was called Dragon's Teeth, but we were sued for the name and we had to change it overnight to Dragon's Claws. Dragon's Claws led to Death's Head. Death's Head was a character Simon had introduced in Transformers. We spun Death's Head out of Dragon's Claws, and then we did an epic book called The Sleaze Brothers, which Andy Lanning drew, and John Carnell, who was a young writer that Andy had introduced to me, and was very talented, full of ideas. So they came up with this, ultimately, ironically, creator-owned book called The Sleaze Brothers, which Archie Goodwin allowed us to publish with the Epic imprint. So in the last sort of year I was at Marvel UK, I initiated these three monthly books, which all folded. One, Dragon's Claws and Death's Head got to issue 10, and Sleaze Brothers was a six-issue miniseries. So we sort of broke into the American market and then shut the door behind us. And they did try some other projects, like a magazine called Strip, which reprinted Martial Law and had some creator-owned projects, but there was never again a creator-owned Marvel UK title. I was also the editor of the comic strip in Doctor Who monthly, and I sort of broke with the tradition of working with one writer and one artist, and I brought in Grant Morrison, wrote a story for me, Brian Hitch illustrated that story, Alan Grant wrote a story, Dougie Braithwaite drew a story that John Connell and I wrote, Lee Sullivan, who was an artist that went on to do Tech World from Marvel, all worked on that strip with me. So in my last year, I sort of was in a very luxurious position of working on a lot of projects, a lot of original projects, at a company that was primarily known for reprinting American material. But my boss at the time felt, I believe, a little threatened by the successes I was having, and we butted heads, and I decided to quit. So that was 89. Now, one of the reasons I decided to quit was my girlfriend was from San Gabriel in California, and she'd come to work at Marvel for 6 months while she was traveling and went home. So I decided to chase her out here, and that's how I ended up in America.
It's always about a girl.
I don't see why an Englishman would like to go to Southern California. That just
don't for a girl.
I don't understand that, you know, the beach, the sun.
Well, I'm sure you can figure out why. But I decided to stay six... Actually, I was only going to stay a couple of weeks in New York, but things didn't work out the way I expected, and I ended up staying in New York 7 months. And it was actually very fortuitous, because I became very good friends with Greg Wright, who was an editor and colorist at Marvel in the 80s. Very acerbic personality, but with a heart of gold. And he said I could sleep on a sofa for a week. And 2 months later, I found myself my own apartment. But if he hadn't really sort of supported me and basically enjoyed having me around and giving me work. I mean, we'd go back to his apartment in the evening, and he would force me to letter strips that he needed the following day. So, and that was back in the hand lettering days. So I got to be known around the Marvel US offices. I got to know editorial. Like, Tom DeFalco had taken over from Shooter in 89, or I think maybe 80. Mm-hmm. I got to know Bobby Chase, Mark Grunwald, Archie Goodwin. I already knew, but I would see those guys around the office and learned a lot more about how Marvel US worked versus Marvel UK, which was insane. There's a lot more pressure on editors at Marvel UK. I would say that editors at Marvel US have twice the workload that's comfortable for any editor in any comic book company. So I could see the sort of crushing deadlines, and I could see, I was often there on Friday when Tom DeFalco would just stick his head into people's office and scream at them about how late their book was. And it helped me understand why a lot of Marvel books were not that good, because they were created under such incredible pressure.
Was this at a time when the bullpen was really still in existence before?
The bullpen was in full swing.
Okay.
And there were a lot of underpaid, overworked, resentful people there at the time. People that I would have run-ins with later when we started doing digital lettering and basically started putting a lot of those bullpenners out of work, because a lot of their work was pasting up lettering that had been done on vellum. And vellum was a sheet of posh tracing paper,
mm-hmm. Sure.
Expensive tracing paper, which you would tape to a Xerox of a page of pencils. Mm-hmm. The page of pencils would have the placements for the lettering, and you would basically letter as if you were lettering on the boards, but on the sheet of vellum.
Mm-hmm.
That vellum was then sent back to Marvel, or you took it in to the offices, and the bullpenners would paint white out on the back of the balloons, cut them out, and rubber cement them down. So it was a very archaic way of working. It terrified me, because it meant that you weren't in control of where the lettering was on the board. At 2000 AD, you lettered on something called patch paper, which is sticky back paper. You lettered on the patch paper, cut out the balloon, stuck it on the actual ink board. At Marvel UK, I actually introduced a sort of American style where you lettered onto the board before it was inked. And then I go to Marvel US and they're doing it completely differently, because pencilers, inkers, and writers are constantly trying to cheat another week out of the schedule, and the letterers were expected to make it up. Not 5 or 6 pages at a time, 22 pages at a time. And I felt I couldn't keep that pace up. So, as much as I tried, and I was lettering Sleepwalker and S.H.I.E.L.D. on a monthly basis while I was living in New York, it was hellacious, and I did not like the quality of my lettering as a result, which ultimately started the sort of train of thought that led me to digitize my lettering styles.
You know, you're obviously credited with ushering in sort of the digital age of lettering in comics. Your name is...
We call it the Comic Craft Age of Comics.
The Comic Craft. There you go. Was it something that was just a natural progression for you in the industry? Was it just the time, that the computers were becoming more of a tool? Or was it sort of a bolt of inspiration that hit you one day? And you know, how did that sort of progress of going from hand lettering to let's do this on computers and let's do this digitally come about?
Well, a very big part of the equation was I moved to New York. I did not have a green card. I had a visitor's permit back in the day when you had a 6-month visitor's permit. I was working sort of under the table because I had worked freelance for Marvel US while I was in England. So I continued to work for Marvel US as if I was still living in England. In fact, all my checks still had my parents' address, because if they did get mail, I wanted to be able to find them. So checks were being prepared for me as if they were going to be sent to England, but I would intercept them at accounts, and they knew to hold the check for me. So I was freelancing, but I hadn't decided that I was going to pursue living in America. It was sort of an accidental arrangement. I really thought I was going to be in New York for 2 weeks max. So I moved out to California and continued this arrangement. You know, the checks were being FedEx to me, but they still had an English address on them. So I had to sort of, in pretty short order, sort out what I was going to be doing. And I knew I wanted to work in comics, but I was in California at this time. I chased my girlfriend out here. We ultimately broke up. And I was living in El Segundo, of all places. I went to the comic book store in Santa Monica, still there, Heidi Hill Comics, mm-hmm. and picked up a copy, ironically, of the Incal, a hardcover edition of the Incal by Graffiti Designs. And I was very pleased to discover that they were based in Anaheim, which was just 40 minutes drive away from me. So I called up and asked them if they had any jobs. Well, unbeknownst to me, Bob Schreck had just quit working Graffiti Designs, and Bob Chapman was sort of looking for someone else. So I made my sort of working situation clear to him, and he offered to sponsor me for a work permit, which he did. And ultimately, I acquired a work permit working for Graffiti Designs. So while I was there, I was doing T-shirt designs. I was actually numbering books back in the day when Bob did hardcover editions of Dark Knight, American Flag, Moonshadow, Electro Assassin, all the Akira books and all the Mobius books. So he was preparing his newsletter called Shirt Tales on a Mac computer. And I was like, oh, great, I'd love to learn how to use a Mac. So Bob, he only had one Mac at the time, which was at home. And I used to go to his home in the evenings and figure out how to do the newsletter with him each month, which was more difficult than it might sound because I never read a manual. I've still never read a manual for a Macintosh computer. But the Quark Express program he was using was fairly intuitive once you got used to it. And I started to know my way around on a Mac. I then found out that some friends of mine from Marvel US had moved out to California. Mark Siri, who was previously an assistant to Ralph Macchio, Dave Wall, who went on to work at Top Cow, Steve Busolato, who eventually set up Electric Crayon with Mark Siri. And Mark Siri said to me, you should digitize your type styles. And I said, I don't know how to do that. He said, my friend Neil can teach you how to do that, which he did. I used to go out to their house. There was four people from New York, most of whom had worked at Marvel US, living in a house in West LA. And they had two or three Mac computers. And Neil would teach me every Monday evening how to use Fontographer and how to use Illustrator.
And this is, what year is this?
91, I think, 91, 92.
Okay, I mean, so it's I'm an art director by trade, so I can kind of, you know, place myself in that time and kind of think about what Macs were there and what the software was.
I had a Mac 2CI.
Okay, wow.
That was nice. My first computer.
High power.
I don't even want to think about how much memory it had. I would probably...
16, probably. No, maybe not even.
It would probably be two meg of RAM and like a 100 meg hard drive, maybe. Maybe.
We had to work in Illustrator and template.
Sure.
You know, that sort of outline style.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very crude and it was very difficult. And the one thing that a lot of people forget now that it's so easy to do digital lettering and work in Illustrator is how difficult it was when I started. So I had to have some fierce determination just to create a single font, let alone letter the books in Illustrator. So, actually, I think I was working in Quark at the time, which was not the best program to work in, Quark Express.
Not at all.
So, you know, I was working with copies of the program that I begged, stole, or borrowed, and just bending my head around a Macintosh, which, it has to be said, is very intuitive to work with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I could ever have got far working on a Windows-based PC. So this is 91, 92... 92, I hired my first assistant full-time, John J.G. Rochelle, who's still working with me today. He worked from his home in Santa Barbara. He was extremely enthusiastic, stopped me working in Quark Express, started me working in Illustrator, started scanning artwork so that we could actually see what we were lettering over, because we were still eyeballing. We were looking at the artwork, lettering it in Illustrator, comparing it to the art, literally holding up the art to the screen to see if it would fit. And we basically, between us, created the method that everybody pretty much uses today to letter comic books. That's why comic book lettering is predominantly Mac-based, is because we were predominantly Mac-based. And a lot of people learned from us, stole from us. A lot of letterers called me, pen letterers who were scared of what the innovations would mean to them. I got a lot of phone calls in the first year or two, people I never heard from again, basically picking my mind and trying to figure out how to do what we were doing.
Hi, this is Andy Parks. You are listening to Around Comics.
I was going to ask you, because I'm a web designer now, but I was a graphic designer at that time, and I remember when Comicraft, the first fonts came out. I remember I was working in Fontographer and Quark and all those programs. But I also remember at the time, you know, digital clip art was very, you know, it first started to come around, and there were so many people that were against digital clip art because they thought it was putting illustrators out of work, and I guess it was to some degree. But I was just wondering, did you get? I'm assuming you got a lot of that same sort of attitude from people that you were.
We got chastised, demonized, outcast. We were, as Mark Grunwald put it to me once, I was the Antichrist of comic book lettering. There were, you know, Kenny Lopez, who's a great guy, and he actually buys fonts from me now. He actually was telling everybody that I was making $1 million a year, which I'm sad to say I never did. And even when we were doing very well, I had 16 people working for me, so... every penny that came in got spent. But John Costanza called me once and accused me of drying up all the work. Tom Ozakowski doesn't speak to me, hasn't for many, many years, because he felt I gave away the means of production. Todd Klein has always been friendly, helpful. We trade information. It's a very healthy professional relationship. But there are other letterers who worked for me, letterers who worked for the same companies as me, who stabbed me in the back and operated in somewhat underhand manner towards me. But I definitely recognize that I turned a sort of journeyman's craft into something that could become a studio team job. I think that's the accusation that's been leveled against me. I turned a craft into a job. But I did so in order to be able to do a better job.
Just because you have a Comicraft font doesn't mean that you're an accomplished letterer.
No, and just because you have a pen doesn't mean you're an accomplished letterer either. And in one of the sort of, we used to get together 14, 15 years ago, Todd proposed a letterer's lunch at San Diego. And seven or eight of us, Steve Dutrow, John Babcock, Todd Klein, Susie Lee, and Ozakowski and Buhalis would get together, and we talked lettering. But ultimately it became a vilification of Comicraft and myself. And Todd...
dinner.
not Todd, Tom Orzechowski actually said to me, "You were putting Janice Chang out of work." And I turned to him and said, "Tom, if you had the choice to hire Janice Chang or Todd Klein, who would you hire?" And he said, "Well, Todd, of course." I said, "You just put Janice Chang out of work." And yeah, that's the truth of it. Nobody hired us because we were cheap and fast. We were cheap. We were at one time the best paid letterers at Marvel. We weren't cheap. We were good and fast. And I think that what a lot of people confused was I raised the bar, and I made it. I could do a good 22-page job overnight with two or three assistants when they were still staying up till 3 in the morning to try to do a good job. Mm-hmm. And the quality showed. The difference showed. And we were able to do quality and quantity. And well, I'll never forget the month we did 17 different X-Men books in 1 month. And I only remember that because we used to have a tray system. We used to have these little shelves that JG made, and it had 16 slots in it. And we got a new X-Men book in, and I couldn't find a slot for it on the X-Men shelves because we'd already taken on, we were already doing 16 books. These are in the days of miniseries and spin-offs and X-Men Unlimited. And it really struck me as amazing that, you know, 5 years previously, I would never have thought that anyone other than Tom Orzechowski would letter the X-Men. And here were we lettering every single X-Men book. Mm-hmm. Too many, some might say. But I honestly believe that it's because we were producing the best work in the fastest time. Not that there weren't other fast letters out there, but there were guys hacking it out with a pen overnight, and it was starting to show, because if you don't get enough sleep, your eyes get tired, your hand gets tired, and your lettering doesn't look consistent. Mm-hmm. Computers don't get tired.
In the beginning, were you also offering the fonts to publishers, or were you solely a studio offering the production of the lettering?
We were a studio offering services, but from day one, the moment I hired John Rochelle, I talked to him about the fact that I wanted to sell fonts. Because, just to take you back to something I said earlier, sheets of Letraset were very expensive. And Letraset sold a lot of sheets. And the thing about a font is you only have to buy it once. But Letraset, you used to have to buy a new sheet every time you ran out.
Sure.
So we used to spend a lot of money in Marvel UK on Letraset. I never forgot how expensive sheets of lettering were. So I always knew that there would be a market for fonts, even when we only just started making them and there weren't that many foundries selling fonts. So I also confidently predicted that once Marvel and DC figured out what I was doing and how I was doing it, they would do it.
Can you explain to people what Letraset
is? I have
is?
To explain what Letraset is.
Yeah, I mean, it's
I'm that
seriously.
Old.
Yeah, we all are, my man. We all are.
Well, sheets of Letraset were sort of plastic sheets with an alphabet of type styles, one particular type style. And if you bought a sheet of Arnold Böcklin, you also had to pick what point size you were purchasing. So if you wanted it big and you didn't want to have to photograph it and change the size of it, you had to pick the point size you were working with. The danger being, the bigger the point size, the fewer letters you get on the sheet. And each sheet, which was about, I'd say about 10 inches by 9 inches, maybe 12 by 9, was a big sheet of lettering. And once you had rubbed down each letter, that was it. You couldn't really reuse those letters.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Each sheet cost about $12.
Did you have your own personal burnishing tool? I know I had mine.
I had several, and we used to put a piece of tape around it and put our initials on them.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, they were expensive. burnishes are expensive.
I bet you could sell those on eBay.
If I still had mine, I would put it in a frame.
Going back a little bit to something you said earlier about how you knew that if you hadn't done it, that the publishers would, and that's, you know, it's interesting to me looking back at it now. I mean, it was just a natural evolution of technology.
Well, John Byrne was the first person that made me sure that was what was going to happen. John Byrne started lettering Namor and another book at the time. Can't remember what it was, but he was doing two books for Marvel, and he started lettering them. Initially, he did a font based on Mike Heisler's lettering, until Mike Heisler asked him for some money. So he did a font based on Jack Morelli's lettering, and made an arrangement with Jack, and has used that font ever since. He also created a font based on Dave Gibbons' lettering, until Dave told him to cut it out. That was used to letter the first Hellboy story that John Byrne wrote. So when I saw that an artist was actually looking into this and enabling him to control lettering, which I think was very significant for John Byrne,
mm-hmm.
I actually spoke to Byrne at San Diego that year and asked him how he was doing it and what program he was using. And he was using, I think, Font Lab or Font Studio at the time. So that was a big clue to me that I'd better, you know, get on the beam or be put out of business. And I definitely saw that would lead to the situation that it has led to, which it means that anyone that has the desire to become a comic book veteran can become one quite quickly if he's determined and prepared to learn. I tried to train a lot of hand letterers, pen letterers at Marvel UK. Not everybody could do it. A lot of people could, but not everybody, and not everybody wanted to continue to do it. And again, this is sort of what Tom Ozakowski accused me of, was taking a skill out of the hands of a skilled craftsman and putting it in the hands of an untrained artisan.
Sure.
I think that's really the issue. In fact, if you go to Greg Rucker's Live Journal, there was a whole debate this week about that.
We did definitely read it, Greg. Greg's been on our show a few times, and we happened to get wind of that, and it was an interesting... I mean, that sort of brings up my next question, is when you see comic craft on a book, what does that mean does that mean that comic craft, as the studio, has lettered that book, or does it mean that that publisher has licensed the font?
No, it means that we've been involved. It means that I have two people working full-time lettering. As I said earlier, we were up to as many as, I think we had 14 people lettering, including myself and John. Two people doing design work and at least one doing administrative work, because once you get past 10 employees, mm-hmm. you're an employer. You've got to have somebody helping you with payroll, human resources, you name it. So that was not a tenable position. I had too many people, but when I had 14 people, Dave Lamphere basically ran a small studio within our studio, lettering all of the acclaimed books for Fabian Nicieza. So Dave would be involved in the lettering work. I would be involved in the lettering work. I basically did titles almost all week long. I did title pages, tag pages. I was involved in the design of the gatefolds that Marvel had in the late 90s. JG and I did logo designs. But also we started building our font catalog that we sold online. And we were one of the very first comic book companies that had a website presence as far back as 1995, I think. So when you see the Comic Craft credit on a book, AG or I have done the title. You know, we sort of specialize in the designy aspects of comic book lettering. If somebody's name is after the Comic Craft studio credit, then he did that book. We barely chop up a book over three or four people unless it's needed literally overnight. We split it into two.
Mm-hmm.
It's become a lot easier to work faster because letterers used to have to transcribe the script we were sent hard copies, not files, Word files. These days, we refuse to work from anything that's not available electronically. A single individual will work on a book and usually stay on a title. Just it's the same as it was 15 years ago when pen letters were working. Jimmy Betancourt, who's worked for me now 9 years, he works on Wallace and Gromit. He does all the Wallace and Gromit lettering. He works on Wolverine, the new Jeff Loeb, Simone mm-hmm. Bianchi series. Albert Deschaine, who's worked for me 10 or 11 years, I think, letters Supergirl, Superman, JG letters Astro City. And I sit outside of my hammock drinking martinis.
Good for you.
Kind of the reason I ask is because I know, you know, because of the live journal, Greg's live journal coming, and I think that's a lot of the confusion still to this day is that people assume, you know, just because someone may use your fonts, that doesn't mean Comicraft's involved in the production. You know,
no, it doesn't. And in fact, there's way more books out there lettered with Comicraft fonts, but not lettered by Comicraft.
Right.
That's sort of it's a great shame. I mean, I see that Dave Lamphere, who worked for me many years, works for Marvel now and uses fonts that he's purchased from us. Now, Dave is a very talented pen letterer and has created some of his own fonts that he used at CrossGen, but chooses to use our fonts rather than create his own. And I think that's a great shame that mm-hmm. There are letterers out there who are not developing that part of the skill,
mm-hmm.
Creating fonts, using their own fonts, rather than using our fonts. I'm very glad that there are customers, but on the other hand, I'd like to see more innovation. You know, Todd Klein creates all of his own fonts. We created his first font, his hand lettering font, but he's created many of his own. Eliopoulos also has created a number of his own fonts. But we've sort of led the field in the amount of fonts that we have in our catalog, because JG and I are both enthusiastic about that part of the creative side.
Sure, you've worked with some amazing creators to develop their own signature fonts. Who are some of those keystone creators that you've worked with?
Well, I can tell you exclusively that Dave Sim called me this week and wants us to develop a range of fonts based on his lettering.
Wow, all right.
That's exciting.
He's been using our Joe Kubert font. Joe Kubert approached us 3 or 4 years ago and we created a font for him. Adam Kubert, Tim Sale, Jim Lee, Joe Madureira, J. Scott Campbell, Paul Smith, Tim Sale, the fonts we created for him are used on the Heroes TV show. We have a font. We made a font for Brian Bolland recently for his Art of Brian Bolland book, and we'll be releasing that this year. Fraser Irving has asked us for a font for Guttsville.
Okay.
We created the official Astro City font. I think that's about it.
I have to be honest. The Around Comics logo, the tagline is in Comicraft Jim Lee.
Jim Lee, yeah.
Yes,
and that's
it is.
Actually a nice font. It's funny because Jim said to me, well, I can't letter. And I said, don't worry. And it does look like he lettered it, if you've seen his handwriting or
right,
signature.
Right, sure.
But he couldn't letter like that.
And we'd like to thank Richard Starkings for talking with us this evening. We're going to cut this one up into two episodes. So
he had a lot to say. I didn't expect the British comics history lesson that we got in the first episode. That was
chatty, cool. That guy.
He's an interesting guy, man. I didn't realize his history and what all he's been doing for the last 20 years. But
hello, I'm Richard Starkings, and this is a history of British creators in comics.
Yeah, no kidding.
So that was fantastic. So you got a great taste of that. We're going to get into more about Hip Flask and the Elephant Men here in a couple days. So please come back and revisit us for part two.
Deuce.
But
Deuce Starkings.
Deuce Starkings Machina.
There you go.
Something like that. All right. Well, until then, I would please ask you to help us spread the Around Comics love. There's a few different ways you can do that. You can take us up on our Listener LCS Challenge by printing out our flyer and displaying that in your local comic shop. Just ask your local comic shop manager or owner to do that. And if they do so, we'll mention both you and the shop on the show and provide a link to the shop on the website. You can become our virtual friend at comicspace.com. That's comicspace.com/aroundcomics. You can do the same thing at myspace.com/aroundcomics. And then you can do my personal favorite, which is the iTunes Music Store review. You can be as cool as Andy Parks, Mike Norton, Steve Bryant, and many others. Special thanks to, is that Nito03?
Nito03.
Arutek and Shane White left us
a review. Shane White, the best looking man in comics.
He is a dapper young man, isn't he?
He's smug, though. He's very smug looking, at least in photos.
But he is a talented mofo. So he did say he looks smug.
Check out all the great things that AroundComics.com has to offer. It's your source for the best in comic book news, reviews, and opinions.
We are proud members of the Comics Podcast Network. You can find more great podcasts at comicspodcasts.com.
Just so everyone is aware, we post the next week's topic on Tuesdays at our forum at AroundComics.com. And we'd like to thank InStock Trades for sponsoring the show. InStockTrades.com has both of the critically acclaimed Hip Flask hardcover editions discounted 35%. You can now follow the Eisner Award-winning adventures of futuristic detective Hip Flask and the Elephant Men for just $19.47 per volume. And that is a deal. That's Remember that InStockTrades.com is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at great discounted prices, and all orders over $50 ship for free.
And you'll hear all about Hip Flask and the Elephant Men on Friday. Is that when we're going to release
Probably Friday. Okay. Don't put a date on it, because who knows what will happen.
Yeah, who knows.
But in the meantime, we are proud to help support the Hero Initiative. Hero creates a financial safety net for yesterday's creators who may need emergency medical aid, financial support for essentials of life, or an avenue back into paying work. It's a chance for all of us to give back something to the people who have given us so much enjoyment over the years. For more information, visit www.heroinitiative.org or call 310-909-7809.
Absolutely. I would like to thank everyone for joining us today. John Suntress, Sal, of course. I'd like to thank Mark for hosting us at Dark Tower, as always. Everyone have a fantastic day or two until the next episode. We'll be back again with part two of Richard Starkings. In the meantime, we'll be everywhere in
and around comics.
If you would like to suggest a topic, send us your comments, or are interested in becoming a panel member, email us at info@aroundcomics.com or visit the Contact Us section of our website. Music for the show provided by the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. Music.podshow.com. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and do not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Thank you for listening today, and remember to join us next time when the panel will change, but our mission will stay the same. Bringing you the very best news, reviews, and opinions in and around comics. Around Comics is a Pipe Dream production. Copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Love you, baby. Yeah.